Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us today, and we hope you had a great Memorial Day holiday. Today on Main Street, we'll bring you the highlights from a live podcast event that was held last Thursday. Prairie Public's In Session podcast took the stage at the Craft Event Space in Fargo, and hosts Ann Alquist and Eric Dethridge were joined by columnist and podcaster Rob Port to break down the biggest stories from the recently ended North Dakota legislative session.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this little intimate, humble gathering of our podcast In Session. It's a thrill to have you.
We want to do a live event for some time, and we're glad to have you here with us.
You know, we were thinking about who we could bring on for this. You know, we were thinking, oh, maybe a politician would be good. Maybe a retired politician, a grizzled veteran news person, or a retired news person even. But we kept coming back to one person, right?
A person who's in the know when it comes to North Dakota politics. A person whose name gets bandied about quite a bit at Prairie Public, especially in our newsroom. And so we thought we would make an effort to reach out to him, because we know politicians talk to him.
Some try to avoid him.
But behind every column that is written, behind every podcast episode, I know we've got some fans here tonight. He is without a doubt an influencer in North Dakota politics.
Yeah, please welcome Rob Port.
Thank you.
So, Rob, I hear you're about to go on vacation. But I don't think this is probably the best time to take one, because we had some news this morning about Governor Armstrong. Yeah. And, man, you cranked out that column. I mean, you cranked it out.
I wrote it from the Chieftain Cafe in Carrington on the way down. Wow. We stopped and we got lunch, and I wrote a column and filed it, and they published it. And I don't think that's going to be resolved until...
And just for context, I mean, this was a big whoopsie moment for Governor Armstrong.
Yeah, so what happened is, the law requires the governor to, when he's going to veto something, and he has a line item veto, but it's only for appropriations bills. And so with this bill, what he did is it was housing funding. And what he intended was to veto this. It was like 150,000, somewhere in that ballpark. We wanted the line item veto that. And that's explicitly because what the law requires, he has to transmit two things to the legislature when he vetoes something. It has to be a veto message, which gets printed in the journal for each chamber. And then he actually transmits the actual amendments, or emendments, I guess, in this case, to the law. And the veto message was correct. That explicitly laid out what he was trying to do. Whoever did the amendments to the law X'd out a section that they shouldn't have X'd, and ended up axing about $35 million in funding that he shouldn't have. He didn't want to veto. Oops. And so now there is a Supreme Court precedent, a state Supreme Court precedent, where the governor cannot withdraw a veto. But I think this is going to be a little bit of a unique situation, because what you have is, he's not trying to withdraw it. They made an error. And his intent is clearly stated in his letter. And obviously the governor is with us. He can tell us what his intent was, what he was trying to do. So it's going to be a question. I have a feeling what they'll probably do is say that the veto is invalid. Because what you have is, you, the two things that you're supposed to transmit are in tension with one another.
The millions of dollars that was supposed to go to, like, the poor and the homeless, that was...
Yep, that would all go forward. He never intended to veto that.
Right.
That was the mistake. What he intended to veto was $150,000, I think, for like a homelessness grant program or something like that. So I have a feeling that probably that's going to be the outcome. I don't think they're going to call the legislature back to Bismarck. That's very, very expensive. I don't think the legislators really want to come. I mean, there's probably some that want to come back to Bismarck. I think most of them are probably sick of each other. They don't want to come back. And the governor doesn't want them to come back, because if he calls them back into special session, he can initiate a session.
Revenge.
But then but then it's hands off. Yeah. You know, he can't. I mean, really, in some ways, if the governor called our legislature into special session, they could just go on forever.
Well, nobody wants to do that, right?
Or at least until the next election, because at that point, the constitutional limit on the number of days they can gavel in is out. So probably the governor doesn't want to bring them back to Bismarck with an open book, especially because he was kind of dunking on the legislators a little bit with some of those vetoes. He was a little aggressive.
Right? Yeah.
One of them was very personal, where it was like legislative. So legislative management got a whole bunch of new staff. They got like 29 new staff. And so they actually, and what the legislature did is they actually wrote into law that our staff gets the 15th floor of the Capitol building in Bismarck, right? And so the governor was like, no. We are the executive branch. You will get your office space the way you don't get to write where your office is going to be in the law. So he line item vetoed and he dunked on them for that. In the ethics budget, they had a couple of sections where they were giving themselves ethics immunity. With section 4 in that budget was probably okay. It was pretty reasonable. It said if you disclose, if you disclose everything appropriately, you can't be prosecuted under the Representative Jason Doctor statute, where and I think that probably makes sense.
That's like a hall pass.
If we're gonna have a citizen legislature, you're gonna have to accept that there's gonna be some conflicts of interest. If they're transparent about it, if they appropriately disclose and recuse themselves, I don't mind them having a degree of immunity. They had another section in their section 5 that gave them like categorical immunity, like because we're legislators, we can't be brought up on ethics. And so the governor,
it's like a president pardoning themselves.
Yeah.
Like if Richard Nixon pardoned himself.
Right. Pure immunity, like some person in Washington has, and you know.
Yeah. Who knew that would ever become a real thing? But now we're, right.
Here
we are. But so he did veto that part and then dunked on them for their reticence to also require themselves to report like campaign expenditures and stuff, which is that we could do a whole podcast just on the hostility between the Ethics Commission and the legislature right now. I will tell you that I oppose the Ethics Commission because I don't think Ethics Commissions do anything. I think we have all sorts of, Chicago has Ethics Commissions and like every other mayor goes to jail out there.
A lot of cities have that. Congress, for some reason.
Congress has Ethics Commission. Congress has an Ethics Committee and they had a congressman from Florida who was a hair's breadth away from getting prosecuted for sex trafficking, and they couldn't do anything with it. Like, you know,
you're talking
about
Matt Gaetz, I guess, right?
So I'm just not really convinced that ethics, but we have it. It's the law now. And some of what the legislature did, I mean, if you read that ethics amendment, mm-hmm. North Dakotans now have a constitutional right to campaign disclosure, right? Which as a reporter, I kind of enjoy. I read all those reports. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but I read a lot of them. And it's for some reason, the legislature has decided, well, we don't have to report expenditures. Well, another part of that amendment also says that they're not allowed to spend campaign contributions on personal expenses. So they can buy parade candy or t-shirts for volunteers, but they can't buy a new fishing boat for themselves. And so that's in the state constitution, but yet how would we ever detect if they did that? They've completely exempted themselves from any sort of reporting that would allow us to detect if they were breaking that part of the constitution. I think the Ethics Commission could sue and probably win.
So you're saying right now they don't have enough teeth to be able to really be effective.
Right. Well, because the legislature is exempting themselves. So, I mean, if you want to go through and I want to enforce this constitutional law that says that you're not allowed to spend campaign money on yourself, how do I do that? I mean, short of getting subpoenas for everybody's bank accounts, which the courts aren't going to go for that, they have to disclose, but they're not disclosing.
Well, let's tie in the Ethics Commission with another big story that was not in the legislative session, but it did kick up discussion about the Ethics Commission, and that was the sentencing hearing of former State Senator Roy Holmberg. Because the legislation earlier in the session really kicked the Ethics Commission in the teeth to give it more funding. And then it kind of died, and then the sentencing hearing happened, and then it got kicked up again that we needed more teeth for the Ethics Commission because of, you know, the horribleness of, you know, who knew
they,
what.
Well, they got some heat. They got some heat. Some of the heat around the Holmberg stuff I think is really hard. I have 344 email threads with Ray Holmberg over the years. And these were professional. He would sometimes send me like dad jokes, and not just to me personally, but like to a lot of people. And I mean, I never had any inkling that he was that he was a monster. And it turned out that he was. So I think there's a lot of games being played right now with Ray Holmberg that people should have known or whatever. And I think that's really unfair. And including some of the people making those accusations served in the legislature with Ray Holmberg. I mean, they were there with him. If everybody knew, why didn't they know? I think, and I have noticed that over the years with political scandals. Like if you're in the news media, and in particularly you're in the commentary part of it, knowing things is the currency, the coin of the realm, right? And so there's a lot of people who like to pretend that they knew things all along. Like after it comes out, suddenly they have 2020. I knew it was coming. I predicted this. And usually they didn't. They didn't know any more than the rest of us.
Do you think we're going to see more fallout from the, you know?
You know, it's hard to say. It seems like, you know, the emails and stuff are, it just never ends. You know, I mean, the Stengem emails, you know, I don't know that we'll ever know if we got all those emails. It just feels like, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, we could.
I mean, do you think there's anything brewing specifically in his district in Grand Forks where he was a counselor for an
Well, that was some of it. I mean, he was an educator. Were there situations at that school? I mean, there could be. I mean, how many coming through the Me Too era and everything? I mean, how many people just came out of the woodwork and just some of the names shocking, you know, what you found out. So, I mean, I think the answer to that is you just don't know. You don't know.
But the story may not be over. We'll just have to wait and see what comes out of that.
I do think that the ethics thing is really interesting because and the ethics thing, because there's two parts of the Holmberg story. There's the horrendous crimes that he committed. But then there's also the fact that he was flying all over the world on the taxpayer dime. And
the corruption.
Yeah, I mean,
the blatant corruption.
A lot of lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, were doing a lot of traveling that they probably didn't need to do. I mean, I don't have a problem if they want to go to, like, another state and learn from the people in that state. If they want to go down to Texas and learn how Texas, you know, does some oil regulation, that's obviously relevant to us here. And that's good. That's the federalist system, states learning from each other. I support that. I don't have a problem with that. You know, I have a problem with like a trip to Aruba, maybe, you know, or what are you doing in like Turkey? You know,
what about the Czech Republic? I mean, under I don't know about the guys, but under the banner of education.
I don't know what the taxpayers of North Dakota were getting out of Ray Holmberg going to Prague. I don't understand that. That sort of travel, it really needed to be scrutinized. And I think that's something, you know, that the Ethics Commission could come up. I kind of wish if they had designed the Ethics Commission, I think, to have oversight over disclosures and campaign, because they really didn't. The Ethics Commission measure was, I think, really poorly written, and a really missed opportunity would have been to put them in charge of like campaign finance violations. I mean, because right now violating campaign finance laws in North Dakota is a joke. I think the first fine's like $25. I mean, it's risible. It's really bad. But why not put the Ethics Commission in front of it? Because the other problem is there are maybe some criminal statutes in there, but good luck finding a state's attorney who's going to take time away from fentanyl dealers and rapes and murderers to try to prosecute somebody for not filing their campaign finance report on time. The state's attorneys don't want anything to do with that. So why not put the ethics committee or the commission in charge of like an administrative process that oversees this? And when there's violations, you can have an administrative process that shames them, maybe levy some appropriate fines, maybe disqualification from the ballot in extreme cases, and maybe, you know, in extreme cases, criminal charges. You know, eventually, once it gets to be, if it becomes a major issue, then the Ethics Commission refers it to for prosecution. I think that's something the Ethics Commission could do and do well. But
well, speaking of North Dakota's cops and top cop in particular, the Attorney General, Eric,
well,
you talked to Drew.
Yeah, I mean, Drew Wrigley, you talked to him recently. I watched the interview, and I mean, it was, you guys were going kind of back and forth, going at each other a little bit there. It was quite dramatic, but I mean, it was not, I think objectively, it was not a very good session for Drew Wrigley. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, one of the governor's vetoes, like one of the things that the governor line item vetoed was out of the attorney general's budget. Under the law right now, judges, we have what's called the 24/7 sobriety program. And so a lot of times judges will use this. It was originally sort of implemented by former Attorney General Wayne Stengem. It was his idea, and it really had to do with DUIs, but they use it pretty far beyond that now. And a lot of times it's kind of a tool to make sure that somebody is staying sober, particularly during the process, because that is a big thing that our courts are struggling with right now, is that in order to prosecute somebody, they have to be well, and they have to be able to participate in their defense. If they are having addiction problems, to the point where they can't participate in their defense, it clogs up the courts. The courts can't proceed. You're going to have constitutional issues. So what we have now is sometimes people, if you get in the 24/7 sobriety program, you have to pay a fee, but the judges can waive that fee. And the attorney general didn't want them to be able to waive the fee. And so that ended up getting added. It was its own standalone bill. It got defeated. It got added to the Attorney General's budget. It passed as part of the budget, and the governor vetoed it. And probably right that he vetoed it, because I have a feeling that probably if that had not been vetoed, that probably would have been challenged in the law, where if you're going to require somebody to participate in this program and they're indigent and they can't afford it, you're going to have constitutional problems.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Today, we're excited to continue this live in-session conversation with journalist and commenter Rob Port. Here's Eric.
Well, you were also going back and forth with the AG about, you know, recidivism and reoffending.
Yeah.
And, you know, his point is he was arguing for longer prison sentences and instead of more of kind of a parole and reintegrating back into society thing. And, you know, he was pretty full-throated in his defense of that. You were, I think you kind of have a defense background in your life, and you were pushing back on that, saying, show me the money, you know, show me the proof that, you know, longer prison sentences leads to people reoffending less.
So criminal defense is kind of the family business. My dad was an Alaska State Trooper, was a homicide investigator. And after he left that, when we moved to North Dakota, he became a private investigator. But he would also be an expert witness on police procedure and things like that. So, you know, we represented people who allegedly committed murders and rapes, and we would get federally appointed in the system. My sister, you know, worked in that as an investigator in that realm as well. I worked with them. Now, I don't want to glorify it. I was mostly making coffee and making copies.
Gotta start somewhere.
But I did absorb a lot.
I think coffee is the fuel of what solves cases.
Yeah. True. Well, I learned my way around the open records laws from that job, which has been very helpful. But Drew he was a former U.S. attorney twice under President George W. Bush and President Trump. And so he comes from the federal system. And in the federal system, they have what's called sentencing minimums. They have for a long time. Now, in some ways, the federal government's kind of been backing away from them. He would really like to see that implemented at the state level. I think that's very problematic. I think that North Dakota, believe it or not, is kind of a progressive place. I know that's a dirty word
to
a lot of people. Kind of a progressive place when it comes to criminal justice reform. We're better than Minnesota when it comes to letting people who were convicted get their voting rights back. We have been implementing, you know, it gets called the Norway model, which I think is probably an oversimplification, but a lot of focus on, while they're incarcerated, focusing on getting them skills, getting them therapy, getting them well, so that when we release them back into society, they don't come back. Now, the Attorney General will tell us that the recidivism rate is awful, but actually our recidivism rate is better than a lot of places in this country. He talks about that we're in the midst of a crime wave, the type A crimes, you know, what's called group A crimes in the reports that his office puts out are actually down. Now, he cherry pick certain crimes that show that they're going up. But overall, the most serious types of crime are basically flat, if not down a little bit in North Dakota. The less serious crimes are down. North Dakota inmates are they're not only getting longer sentences already over the last 15 years, they're actually serving more time behind bars already. So in many ways, we're already doing what he asked for. Now, he and I got a little heated. I like Drew, and you know, we have a good professional relationship, but you know, at one point he got frustrated with me and he accused me of wanting to close down all the prisons. And I said, that is obviously not what I'm saying. And it got a little heated, but he is his political approach to that issue too is very un-North Dakotan. Like, he is very, very aggressive.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of lawmakers that aren't used to that.
Right.
We have made a lot of very good progress on criminal justice reform in North Dakota. I would not like to go backwards.
Yeah. So speaking of North Dakota niceties and nice, you know, from my observation, being here now, well, total cumulative time, 14 years, people that serve in the legislature are just good, down to earth, salt of the earth kind of people. And you talked about like some cracks in North Dakota's Republican Party as the national politics are playing out now, but at the district level too, after the death of Representative Cynthia Schreiber Beck, she's from the Wahpeton area, right?
District 25, yep.
Right. So describe what kind of person she was, what kind of lawmaker she was, and why that's a tough seat to fill, both literally and figuratively.
Yeah, Cindy Schreiber Beck, and you said family friendly, so I'm not going to repeat.
We can bleep it and cut it out.
You want,
but your daughter is here.
Yes, that's all right. But she I mean, she was somebody, of, I mean, she was, you know, that's, right? I mean, she was very blunt. She was a very good lawmaker, though. She would work with whoever was going her way. She didn't fight dirty. I mean, she was just somebody doing the work. I think it's fashionable among the public to think of somebody in elected office and they think that it's this kind of glamorous thing. There is nothing glamorous about serving in the North Dakota legislature. You know, most of them are losing money.
Yeah.
I mean, they get paid a significant amount of money, don't get me wrong. And they have a health benefit that is very lucrative. So don't get me wrong. I'm not downplaying that, but a lot of them are losing money. But to your point about, you know, sort of this infighting in the NDGOP, there are factions within the party where you have sort of the traditional Republicans who have been there for a long time. They're going to be gone. I mean, a lot of them are aging out, and then also term limits are looming. And then you have a new wave of very populist, sort of mega Trump era, very different breed of Republicans. And there's been a fight within the party to control. So while the legislature has been going on, everybody's been paying attention to the legislature. The parties have been reorganizing. And in the NDGOP, they are electing the local district officials who will endorse the next wave of Republican candidates. And we actually have a law that Representative Jim Casper from Fargo here put in. It's called the Casper Amendment. And what it does is it actually says that the political parties are not allowed to set bylaws for their constituent districts, which is absurd. So what this means is that the North Dakota Republican Party is not allowed to have one set of rules that govern the district chair elections or that govern the candidate selection process for each place. So what you're having is they will actually hide the rules from candidates so that they can't follow the rules to get the Republican endorsement. And in most parts of the state, the Republican, if you're the endorsed Republican candidate, you're getting elected. That's just the political reality. So by being able to control that process, they can control who gets elected. And that's how they're winning. I don't think that faction has the numbers in the larger public, but that they have the numbers in these little convention, you know, district conventions that are attended by maybe a couple dozen people, depending on where you're at. And they're winning there. They're going to control the party.
So what's it going to mean for Wahpeton for original District 25?
Well, so what happened in Wahpeton specifically is they held a convention, and at that convention, they used proxy voting. So people who weren't in the room were allowed to cast votes through other people. District 25 has been doing that for a while because this has come up for a long time. So they've just been doing what they've always been doing. The party said, no more, you can't do that. You got to hold a new convention. So then they held a new convention and they elected another person. And these are two very different. The first person that got elected, very much a moderate Republican. Second person that got elected, very much a populist person. But they didn't notice their meetings properly because state law requires that they have to notice the meeting. So they're meeting it. So now there was a May 15th deadline whereby everybody had to have the reorgs done. That's in the state law. We're now past that deadline. They have two district chairs elected. And then Cindy Schreiber-Beck passed away, which is terrible. So what happens is, in law, the Secretary of State has to notify the Chairman of Legislative Management. That's Senate Majority Leader David Hogue. David Hogue then has to notify the chair of the district committee that there's been a vacancy. And then the district committee then appoints the replacement. What the law doesn't provide for is who gets notified if nobody is the district chair. We don't know. Apparently, there's going to be a state committee hearing, and it may get resolved there, but we may see litigation. And meanwhile, the people in District 25 are without a representative, which probably isn't a huge deal right now.
I was going to say, in 2 years, are they going to have somebody?
But there's interim work. Yeah, I mean, there's interim committee hearings. But really, it's more a story about how dysfunctional the Republican Party is. And you have to wonder how much longer can they continue to function like that? Although maybe they can, because the Democratic Party hasn't exactly shown an ability to get off the mat.
If you're just joining us, I'm Tate Galloway with Prairie Public, and this is Main Street. We're in the middle of a special live in-session taping with Rob Port. Now, here's Ann, Eric, and Rob.
I got a question about term limits since that came up as well, because it's going to be on the ballot, you know, so it's going to clean up some of the language. But I mean, you're talking about the future of the North Dakota Republican Party. So with term limits, you know, and as Eric and I were doing the podcast, I was watching a lot of the committee work, and there, I mean, definitely a lot of legislators long in the tooth, and they knew processes. I mean, I feel like Senator Beckedahl from Williston, I call him the explainer legislator. I felt like his job was the kind of life.
He's in local government.
And he's a Williston city commissioner as well. I'm curious, like, what your take is on with term limits and we've got people transitioning out because they're required to, who's up and coming? Who are we going to start seeing? And is that going to be problematic, especially in the really rural areas where there are just only so many people?
Well, I think candidate recruitment was hard in some of these rural areas as it is. And not just, I mean, but first of all, it's hard to find people who can take 4 months off every other year and also during the interim make regular trips to Bismarck for interim.
Do you think it's going to put more pressure on the question about whether or not to make it a professional legislature or do some kind of hybrid?
I think so. I mean, something's going to have to give. And I think the ethics part is part of that question, too, because you're asking people. I mean, somebody who comes in who's running a successful business is probably going to have times where their bottom line intersects with the stuff that they're legislating on. Well, now we've created sort of a minefield for even people who are trying to act in good faith. You've created kind of a minefield where they could face ethics challenges for that. A lot of them may wash their hands and say, no, I'm a successful person. I'm not going to take 4 months every other year away from my job and also face all these ethics problems. And also, I mean, the political climate we're living in. I mean, there was a Williston City Commissioner who just resigned for over threats. Tate Simbalek. I was just talking to him earlier this week. Resigned because his family was facing a lot of threats. He wasn't, I guess there's legal things going on and he wasn't willing to talk more in depth about it. I actually have a print column coming out about it over the weekend, but it's tough to recruit legislators as it is. And then you add term limits on top of it and you're going to have to recruit more often. That's going to be a tough thing. I think what the legislature put on the ballot, and they're going to get a lot of blowback from that they're being self-serving, but I think the amendment that they're making is reasonable. And they're doing two things. First of all, what they're saying is that right now it says you can't serve more than two terms in one chamber. So really that's 16 years total you could serve in the legislature because you could serve two in the House, two in the Senate.
And Josh Boshay on your podcast is saying, well, you know, no shame in going back to the House.
Right. Well, yeah. Josh went from the House to the Senate. But we're still capping it at 16 years, but you can serve all 16 in one chamber. I think that takes some of the pressure off. I think that makes it a lot better. There's still the limit, but you don't have to bounce back and forth between the chambers. I think that helps keep some institutional knowledge. But the other thing is when they drafted that ballot measure, and I think this is an intriguing legal question, they actually put in there that the legislature is not allowed to initiate an amendment to that part of the Constitution. And I think that's unconstitutional. I don't know how you can tell the legislature that they're not allowed to legislate. You know, any more than this legislature could pass a law and say, we're not ever going to fund bike lanes anymore, right? Well, future legislatures are obviously not obliged to honor that. It's a new legislature. You know, there's different people that are serving and whatnot. So they can't, if that part is allowed to stand, then basically what we could do is we could just, every ballot measure that's going to come through is going to have that language in it that says the legislature is not allowed to amend this. And then at what point do we end up where we're just going to do all the legislating at the ballot box? We won't even have a legislature anymore. I think that's absurd. I'm hoping that part of the reason why they put that amendment on the ballot was to challenge that specific thing. And I hope it does get challenged. And by the way, the whole thing is an exercise in this group, U.S. Term Limits, wanting to get this whole thing back before the U.S. Supreme Court. Back in the 90s, they lost. The Supreme Court struck down state laws putting term limits on Congress. So it was U.S. term limits that actually the age limit for congressional delegation, they were behind that one. And they were also behind, obviously, the term limits for the state officials. They want to use North Dakota for another legal challenge because they're thinking in the 90s, Clarence Thomas wrote kind of a scathing dissent against, it was D.C. versus Thornton. I think that's the case. But Thomas had kind of a scathing dissent. I think they're banking on the idea that this court is probably more aligned with Justice Thomas these days. And so they really want North Dakota to be a vehicle for their legal challenge.
And be a bellwether. What would that mean for the rest of the country if they went?
Yeah, I think term limits it's funny to me that term limits is this populist, like we the people thing, when really it's a limit on who we the people can vote for. Like if somebody's getting elected to office over and over again, who's doing that? I could do a whole podcast, too, on how
we could do so many whole podcasts. We're going to do one on the legacy fund, probably, too. Hold that thought. I want to make sure we have time for questions. I did just kind of want to take a 30,000-foot view, though, because we just had the big, beautiful bill that just got by a whisker in the House, speaking of national politics and split between, like, the Republican and the Democrats. But I'm just curious to ask you, you started out as a blogger, and now you're a columnist, podcaster, writer, reporter, influencer. And I'm curious, you've definitely got a bent. You're a conservative, but that word has taken on a completely different tone. At dinner, you and I were talking about the conservatives of yore, William F. Buckley, George Will, Ronald Reagan. And I'm curious about how you would define a conservative in 2025, and if you identify with that.
Yeah, well, being on public broadcasting is probably not helping my conservative creds very much. It's really
hard. And Newt Gingrich used to listen to NPR.
Yeah. Newt Gingrich.
I don't know if he does anymore, though.
I'm a Prairie Public subscriber. I want to watch, you know, All Creatures Great and Small. I can't go without it. You know, I don't know. I don't know what it means to be a conservative anymore. I mean, conservatives used to be very free trade. Although it could be that we were wrong about free trade. I'm telling you, I was listening to this book, Autocracy Incorporated, on the way down, and the degree to which countries like China and Russia and others have used our willingness to trade with autocratic regimes. The theory was that when we traded with them, it would create prosperity and relationships, and then we wouldn't go to war with one another. And really, we just helped fund them. And they're still doing all sorts of awful things. So, you know, maybe that was a mistake, but, you know, this is a party that has taken a shift towards populism. And in a lot of ways left me behind. I am not a populist. In fact, I think a lot of the most genius aspects of the American system of government, the American connotation of small r republicanism is the fact that it's anti-democratic in a lot of ways. You know, they were very much afraid of, I mean, you can listen in the Federalist Papers, you can read Madison, you know, in particular, sort of talking about what pure direct democracy and sort of being governed by the whims of the mob. It feels very much like we are living in through the most populist era in American history. And a lot of that has to do with social media and everything. But, you know, they just left me behind. Conservatives used to be about federalism, about states, about limited government. And now it seems very much about grievance and using the power of government to try to impose a certain way of life on people. And I'm just not for that. And I don't know if that makes me a conservative still or not.
Who knows what with the labels these days, what is what. But one thing
I've decided not to care that much.
Apparently not. But one thing that we have noticed as fans, Rob, over the years, I got to kind of drill down on this. Just talking about your growth as a professional doing what you do and the audience that you've grown over the years, but just what we all observe, just talking around the water cooler, you know, 10 years ago, it was like, oh man, Rob Port, I don't agree with anything. Blah, 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 you know? And then there was a time where, like, oh, I agree with Rob Port. I agree with this article. Holy cow.
The worst person I know just said something I agree with, right? Isn't that frustrating? Like, occasionally Trump's right about something, right. And it's like,
well, I mean, I have to say, all of us who are talking and jabbering about it are like, we noticed some metamorphosis, some transformation in the way you write, maybe not necessarily your core views, but in sort of the more empathetic way you would write about people. And it did come maybe coincidentally, maybe not, around a time that you had a near-death moment and you wrote quite eloquently.
Well, everybody thinks I got COVID and became a liberal.
All right. I guess that's the wind-up to say, did you become a liberal because of COVID, Ron?
No. You know, what really, I mean, Trump getting elected was it just watching it happen in real time in 2016. And then January 6th was almost like a radicalizing event to me. I don't understand how people can excuse. I mean, that's a red line for me. At that time, a sitting president of the United States incited a violent attack on Congress. That should be unacceptable. And yet here we are, where not only, you know, did we reelect him and he pardoned all the people who did it. And it's a terrible thing. I mean, you got to remember, I started a blog when I was 22 and didn't think anybody was going to read it. You know, it wasn't until I was about 4 years in, I think it was the 2006 cycle, and the North Dakota Republican Party was going to be holding their state convention in Minot. And I emailed the executive director, who went on to become a pretty good friend of mine, Jason Sturrock. I emailed him and I said, can I come and watch? I said, I'm just a blogger, so I don't know if I can get media credentials, but is it possible just for me to just come and sit off to the side and observe? And he emailed back and he said, of course, you're the media. We'll get you credentials right away. We all love your blog. And I was terrified that people were reading this stuff.
Pressure.
And I was like, I gotta
gotta produce now.
I'm gonna have to start using spell check. Part of it was I never intended this to happen to me.
Hey, you had a day job and everything, right?
Worked for my dad for 10 years. And then, you know, I kind of lost doing investigations like that. Just wasn't for me. So I went to work for Home of Economy in Minot for a while. I was selling car batteries and stuff. And I, well, I was managing the store. And they wanted somebody to rehabilitate that store. And I was trying to figure out what I was doing. And I was doing this blog thing on the side. And then more people just kept reading. And just, sure, I've changed over time. We treat change like it's this terrible thing. I hope most of us are not the same people we were when we were 22 years old.
That's right.
I mean, if you are, you've got a problem, right? Okay. Like, if I'm a 44-year-old man still behaving like I'm 22,
yeah,
that's a problem.
If you're saying, get off my lawn, you know, right. Like, that's a problem.
That's what I am.
So speaking of the evolution.
I was kind of a get off my lawn guy when I was 22, though.
Okay, so. Yeah, you were. Hence the surprise. Yeah. So another surprising thing that you said, you didn't consider yourself a journalist. Now, I wonder if that's changed, okay? Because you're part of this new media, you're blogging, you're podcasting, you're connected to so many important people in North Dakota.
I'm an employee of the largest journalism organization in North Dakota.
That's right. Well, there's that. And also, too, the difference between reading an opinion column that you write and some others, it's not just opinions. It's not just throwing something out there.
Yeah.
You source a lot of your stuff because you have a background in FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, investigation, and your work with your dad probably helped you along those lines, too. So a lot of the stuff that you get is factually revealing. So do you consider yourself, in that light, a journalist?
One quick tip, don't ever mention FOIA if you can. FOIA is a terrible. It takes forever. And if the state people can get you into the FOIA system, they will. Use North Dakota's open records laws if you can. They're so much better. They're so much quicker. When people like what you write, you're a journalist. And when they don't, you're a filthy, stupid opinion blogger. You know, the journalism thing is people think it's good journalism when it's a result that they like. You're not a journalist when it's not. And
you're
so much of that.
Right. You're just a hack or something.
It's so much of that's going on now where it's people's. And that's really the problem with the media environment now. I mean, we think of it's like a top down thing. Like this is something Fox News and MSNBC is doing to us. And really, it's a bottom-up problem. They're doing it because there's a market for it. And less so those. I mean, their audiences are shrinking. It's all the people on YouTube and the podcasts and Tucker Carlson. There's an audience for stuff like that. And that's terrifying. If nobody wanted to listen to Tucker Carlson give airtime to a guy who thinks Winston Churchill was the villain in World War II.
I'm hearing you say the fault is in ourselves and not in our stars.
I could do a whole podcast on how it's the public's fault. And nobody wants to say it because everybody's afraid of losing voters or losing audience. But we're doing this to ourselves, and it's about time we took some responsibility for it.
Let's hold a mirror up to ourselves.
Yeah.
Let's take some time for some questions from the audience.
So we're in Fargo for this taping. Bismarck put the kibosh on the city's distinctive approval voting. Rob, do you think that the state should tell local governments how to manage their elections?
Yeah, that's the local control argument is another favorite hobby horse of mine because people like it. It depends on the situation, right? I think that there are some things that are appropriate to have local control over and some things that there are not. For instance, when it comes to regulating the oil industry, I don't think we need each county to have its own set of oil regulations. I think that's absurd. I think we should make one set of regulations for the whole state. I think when it comes to something like voting, I don't think that should be a local control issue. Fargo's got a problem, like a long-standing problem of thinking that their home rule charter gives them authority to just do whatever they want. Apparently, the mayor still thinks so, although they're not going to challenge this. But they've challenged several laws over the years, and they've lost over and over again. As far as voting, personally, I don't like approval voting, but people of Fargo did vote for it in an off-year election. A very tiny sliver of the electorate voted for it. So I guess there's that. But I like the idea of North Dakota having uniform election laws. I mean, we have debates all the time about voter ID laws making things too confusing for people to vote or not informing people appropriately. I think it's really weird to have like a couple of certain types of local elections in one jurisdiction that are done one way and all the other elections are done the other way. I think it behooves the state of North Dakota to have one set of election laws for them all. This is how we do elections. And if we want to change that, then change it for the whole state. You want to do approval voting for the whole state? Good luck. You know, if we're going to do it, it should be the same everywhere. That's my primary concern.
What's your problem with approval voting?
I don't think it achieves what the supporters say it does. you know, there's a lot of pie in the sky stuff about better candidates and everything. And I don't know. It ain't broke, don't fix it, I guess. I don't think it would hurt if we did it. But I do think it would be a lot more confusing. And again, we deal with confusion around elections a lot. And approval voting is kind of confusing.
First, a quick public apology. Started just as a blogger. In 2007, I was the executive director of the Democratic Party, and this blogger was calling me for comment about a very controversial donation we took. And I remember saying, why would I talk to a blogger? I don't want to talk to him. And now you're behind the microphone and I'm out in the sticks.
This is Jamie Selzer, who, when he was 12 years old, taught me to be a paperboy to deliver the Minot Daily News when I was 10.
There's that as well. But you said earlier that information and knowledge is sort of the coin of the realm for you. Has this perception of you by some on the right made it harder for you to get information and do your job?
Yeah, not really. Even if people know they're going to be written about critically, they still like getting their name in the paper. So there's that. And, you know, the thing is, and this is maybe inside baseball, and maybe it sounds terrible, but, you know, everybody's got an axe to grind against everybody else. And the one reputation that I've developed is I don't really care who it is. If you show me a story, I'll write that story. And I think that reputation really helps me, you know, mostly in that, you know, they'll bring me things about the people that they don't like, knowing that I'll write about them. You know, and maybe that's terrible. I don't really care what their motivations are. The truth is the truth.
Okay, could it also be your audience? I mean, I would guess that, but I don't have your numbers or anything like that, your segmented audience, but I imagine you were appealing to a lot of young voters, young families. I mean, you look around North Dakota, the eyeball shows you this is a young state. The numbers are showing that too. Could it be like they want to come to you so they can get their stories and messages out to the voters they want to cultivate?
Yeah, well, I think part of it is I've kind of got a reputation of doing certain types of stories. You know, I can be a little bit of a muckraker. I'm willing to probably go places that people get a little intimidated by, and I don't care. I think if you're in this business to get invited to the right cocktail parties and stuff, you're doing it wrong. I'm very lucky that I am a terrible, terrible introvert. I don't really want to go to anybody's party, even if they invited me. So.
Hey, hope this one ain't bad. Who's next? Another question or two here.
As a columnist, you get to be a solo act, but you've chosen to have a co-host for your podcast. How did that come about?
Listening to people monologue is super boring, and I'm not good at it, you know? I mean, like somebody like a Rush Limbaugh could do it great. Like, whatever you thought of his politics, like, he was a talented performer, right? I mean, the things that he could do with his voice, I can't do that. And I like talking to people, and I think, you know, I did talk radio for a while, and I didn't really like talk radio very much. I think it's because you have to do a show every day. I think one of the reasons talk radio exaggerates so many things, or they invent problems, is because they have to have something to talk about to get callers going every day. Podcasts is not that. You don't have to do the podcast, right? You can change the schedule around. And then also, you don't take calls. Like, I enjoy feedback. I like talking with people, but I'm not worried about how many calls we get during an episode. So going from talk radio to podcasting really made me realize there's some things with that medium that are, and cable news, I think, is the same, that are really kind of toxic. But, you know, I enjoy it. Chad Oban is my co-host. Chad and I, Chad also a former executive director of the North Dakota Democratic Party, who also I gave to at times, and he gave me. But it's really nice. First of all, we get along. We're good friends. Both, as anybody listen to podcasts know, both total baseball nerds. And, you know, we get along well. And it's nice to have somebody who can speak about North Dakota politics at a granular level, to drill down and be like, oh, look what's happening at District 25. And surprisingly, there's an audience for that. I mean, who knew?
We don't have professional sports in North Dakota. I'm quoting our news director, Dave Thompson. So we have to talk about politics.
Yeah. It's a sport, all right. Rob, one of the things I really appreciate about your articles is you do a good job of the function of journalism, which is creating accountability for elected officials. So I think about articles you've written on Representative Rios, Senator Corey, Representative Doctor, the Young Republican group chat.
I almost had to testify in Representative Doctor's trial.
That was
a close thing. We had to fight to keep me off the stand because I did not want to.
So as I read all of these columns, the thing that always strikes me is as much accountability as you're putting out into the electorate and through North Dakota news media, that it hasn't always seemed to have its impact in changing the electorate's behavior. So I'm kind of curious your reaction on kind of what you see from, especially in those districts, the change is not happening even when it feels so obvious to so many people.
Democracy is premised on the idea that the voters are going to make in the aggregate, make good decisions. And they're supposed to care about things like accountability. They're supposed to care that the elected officials are not lining their own pockets and they're not being abusive or of their power or what have you. I don't know what to do. I don't know how democracy functions if the voters stop caring about those things. And I think we're living through an era right now where they have demonstrated that they don't care that much about things. And obviously, I mean, Trump is the behemoth example, but let's be honest, it's been happening on, look at how long Senator Bob Menendez clung to office. They had his DNA on gold bars that were used to bribe him. And that guy was still in office. You know, Anthony Weiner left office with a disgusting sex scandal and then tried to run for mayor and may have gotten elected mayor of New York, but for the fact that he, you know, had another sex scandal. Look at the two people who are running for the mayor of New York now. I mean, talk about a race to the bottom. And I don't know what to do with that the voters don't care about it. All I can do, I can't make the voters care about things. I mean, they're still reading. I have a very large audience. I think they care about it from in the same way that they like to slow down when they're driving by traffic accidents. But I don't know that they care enough to change the way they're voting. And that's probably a reflection of how partisan things are, you know, where it's like, yeah, they're really bad, but they're not so bad. I'm going to vote for a Democrat, you know, or a Republican, as the case may be.
A second ago, you were talking, or I guess a minute ago, you were talking about term limits and how it can oftentimes limit the public's ability to vote. And I was wondering about your thoughts on this. There's a lot of studies out there showing that just the most popular name ends up winning, especially right. If they have the D or R behind their name.
Mm-hmm.
And so the incumbent will oftentimes win just because
name
they're just because of name recognition. So by having term limits, it forces new blood. It's not necessarily that the incumbent is the best. It's just that people go, oh, well, I know them, so I'm going to vote for them. And so not restrictive term limits. I agree with you that the 8 and 8 causes a lot of problems, especially in a citizen legislature. But like a full 16 or maybe 20 or, you know, something where we don't have somebody who serves 40 years because of name recognition.
H.O. Mencken had a quote that said that the voters deserve to get what they voted for good and hard. And I'm a big believer in the voters having to face it sometimes. If you want somebody, and sometimes somebody who served for 40 years might be a really good lawmaker or elected official. So I don't know. I struggle with that. I think that if we, maybe a good compromise is we just lengthen the term limits out a little bit. Maybe that's fair. I understand where it's coming from. I just don't understand how it's this populist thing where, you know, the voters are going to restrict what they voted for. Speaking of the name recognition, though, I have a fun anecdote. So we had a state auditor who for a long time was Bob Peterson. And we had actually a state auditor named Bob Peterson for like almost 60 years. And the thing was, his father was Bob Peterson too. But the thing about it is that the second Bob Peterson, his middle name was Robert. His first name wasn't Robert. His first name, I think, was Scott. Randy, okay. I got that one wrong. Thanks for the fact check. But he started, when he ran for office, he started going by his middle name so he could just keep, people just kept voting for Bob Peterson for state auditor. Also, I don't think North Dakota's ever elected a Democrat as auditor. I think that's the one. I don't think we ever have, going back to statehood. There was also another story where a guy who ran for judge, and I actually broke this story. He was running for judge somewhere, a rural area, and I'm forgetting where. But I actually dug up, and he was from Cincinnati originally. And while he was in Cincinnati, he got in trouble with the local bar because he was running for a judgeship or something down there. And there was this political family that was like very famous, like very well-known political name in, you know, kind of like a Hovind or something in North Dakota. And he actually changed his name, like full-on changed his name, so he had the same last name as them to try to get himself elected. And he got in trouble for it. And ultimately, I think the court would not let him change his name. But then he moved to North Dakota and he ran for judge here. And I broke that story. So yes, name recognition is hugely powerful, which I would argue is another indictment of voters. I would hope that you're paying more attention to these people than just voting for the name you recognize.
Well, thanks for the H.L. Mencken reference. He's from Baltimore. And that redeems you for that Yankees tweet. Thank you, Rob. Hey, audience, you know, we should have just turned the mic over to you the whole time. Those were great questions. Well, that about wraps it up, right?
Yeah, that's going to wrap it up for our first taping of In Session. We had a blast putting it together for you. I think this is our first time taping in the space of Craftwell. So thank you, Craftwell, for hosting us. Daniel Webster is our afternoon drive host and is our new co-host for Prairie Beat. We've been doing the podcast as in session. The legislative session is over, but Danielle is going to take on the reins and give you a deep dive into all things North Dakota. Well, probably just one thing. Just one thing. Because my rule is about our podcast is that it's got to be between 8 and 10 minutes. And if it's longer than that, I will personally come in with a machete. So
What happened here?
I get soft. You know, there's a soft side to me.
Yeah.
Right.
I was having a good time. By the way, everyone subscribe to the forum.
Yeah. How can everybody get hold? I mean, everybody reads and watches you anyway, but tell everybody that's listening in the podcast how they can subscribe.
Find me on social media. I only post stuff about because I hate social media, but I do post links to my articles. You can find me obviously in the Fargo Forum, and the podcast is Plain Talk, which you can search for wherever you get your podcasts.
Rob's been great having you, man. Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, Craft Event Space. Hey, hope you enjoyed this week's episode of In Session. Tay Calloway is our radio studio operator. Christine McClellan is our communications manager. And Leah Peterson is our digital communications specialist. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Ann Olgus.
And that's it for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, look forward to some sizzling stories, beefy mysteries, and a whole lot of fun because we're talking burgers. That's right, we'll give you the entire history of the hamburger. Why is the word ham in hamburger? Anyway, we'll find that out, plus a whole lot more about the 50 billion hamburgers we consume each year. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to seeing you again.